From South Dakota Public Broadcasting, I'm Paul Guggenheimer, and this is Dakota Midday for Tuesday, November 2nd, 2010. Today is Election Day. We're going to get a feel for the mood that folks are in this Election Day with Gannett writer and South Dakota native Chuck Rosch. You can read Chuck's work in the Sioux Falls Argus Leader and USA Today. He says huge rallies like last weekend's rally to restore sanity and or fear have personified the election of 2010 more than anything else. Chuck Rosch covered the rallies and joins us to share his thoughts. Also today, speaking of writers, Yankton writer Jim Reese has just been nominated for a Pulitzer Prize for his most recent collection of poetry called Ghost on Third. He'll join us to talk about that and his work teaching inmates at Yankton Federal Prison Camp. And a bizarre season for the Minnesota Vikings continues with the release of star receiver Randy Moss, whom they signed just weeks ago. Sioux Falls Argus Leader sports editor Stu Whitney will be here to try and make sense of it all. This and more on today's edition of Dakota Midday. First, this news. It's Dakota Midday. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. Today is Election Day, and hopefully you'll take the opportunity to vote. We're going to get a feel for the mood that folks are in on this Election Day with Gannett writer and South Dakota native Chuck Rosch. You've read Chuck's work in the Sioux Falls Argus Leader and USA Today. He says huge rallies like last weekend's rally to restore sanity and or fear have personified the election of 2010 more than anything else. Chuck Rosch covered the rallies and joins us on the phone from Washington to share his thoughts. Chuck, welcome back to Dakota Midday. How are you?
Hi, Paul. Thanks.
Happy Election Day. Are you happy that it's about to that all of the run-up is about to end?
Well, run-up is a good word because I think the action is probably going to take a short little respite after the election, but I'm looking to what's happening after the election to be almost as interesting and as tumultuous, frankly, as what we've had over the last year or so in this election.
You use the word tumult or tumultuous. Why is that?
Well, because I think there's if indeed it turns out the way it looks, like the Republicans are going to take one or both houses of the Congress, I think the nature of the new Republican majority that particularly is going to rise in the House of Representatives is going to be very interesting to watch, to see both the pressure they put on the president and on the Democrats and to push back on their agenda, but also on the Republicans, because a number of these newly elected Republicans that are going to come into Washington, I believe, are going to put as much pressure on their own party to adhere to smaller governments, less spending, the types of things that I think we're going to have to fight out in Congress over the next 2 years.
Well, we can get into some of that a little bit later. But when last I spoke to you on your cell phone, mm-hmm. It was Saturday. I had been watching the rally to restore sanity and or fear, along with a lot of other folks in the United States. And you were there. You were leaving the rally. It had just ended, and you were amongst what it sounded like a sea of humanity. And there was a lot of noise and excitement that was going on. What was it like to be there? What was this all about anyway?
Well, I think it was at the heart, it was supposed to be sort of an anti-politics as usual rally. And as I pointed out in a column that's running right now in USA Today Online, there were three rallies this year that I think really personified this, and this was the third of the three. This one in particular, I think, was a pushback against the Glenn Beck rally in August, and it was sort of a way for both the Colbert and John Stewart to sort of to answer that rally in August. It was definitely a Democrat left leaning rally. There was no doubt about that, as was opposed to the Beck rally, which was mostly conservatives. But it was an interesting event because I wrote the column today about a lot of the signage at the event, and one of the more interesting signs that I focused on was a guy from Florida who'd flown up for the rally, and he was holding a sign that said, I can't even remember exactly what it said, but the essential message was, I'm angry at everybody who's angry. And
I think the exact one. Yeah. I'm looking at your column. Yeah. I'm mad as hell at people who are mad as hell.
Right. And I just thought that sort of typified what I think has been kind of the oversubscription of anger in this election. A lot of people in my business have described this as an angry electorate, and even at times I've seen that involved. But I think there are two other A words that are more apt at this moment. I think anxiety and angst are more to the point of what Americans are going through right now. I don't think they're as angry as they as much as they are worried about kind of the direction of the country and where we go next and who's going to win out in this great political season and battle that we're in.
Now, the rally to restore sanity and or fear, some people characterize it as a partisan event. You said you felt that it was you definitely characterize it as a left liberal leaning, Democrat leaning. What about it would lead you to come to that conclusion?
Well, first of all, Celinda Lake, a prominent Democratic pollster, she surveyed people there. She did actually a poll of people there, and 86% said they were going to vote Democratic if they were going to vote on Tuesday. So that pretty much says it. And also,
if I can just jump in, wouldn't it be predicated more on the intent of those who are holding the rally and Jon Stewart and Stephen Colbert, who are comedians at heart? Although certainly Jon Stewart would admit that he has he's denied having a political agenda, but yet he would seem to have one. But he says that's not what this was all about.
Well, I mean, he can say that, and I understand what he's trying to do. But on the other hand, I think a lot of people that left that rally were energized within the political process. So to me, it was a political rally with comic and political satire overtones. I don't think he would deny that he is a political satirist and in the moment and has had influence on the election. And I think if I talked to a lot of people at the rally there, and a lot of them were very engaged, very politically engaged. They were not engaged.
So these were not people who showed up and they were anti the body politic. They were they were political animals at heart.
Right.
And so what did you come away with as far as, one of the things that you said in your piece, for example, was maybe this was the beginning of the post-election hangover when the anger and fear headache begins to go away.
Right.
At least that's what some were hoping.
Right.
Is that what happened?
Well, I don't know. We'll have to see. I posit it as a question. I don't know. I do think there's a yearning in the country of all the voters I've talked to on all different ends of the political spectrum this year. I do believe there is a yearning in the country to get beyond sort of the name calling and the recrimination and, you know, whose fault it was and all that sort of thing. And I don't think this election has allowed us to get beyond that. But maybe the act of voting and maybe the act of going forward as people sift through the results of this day, particularly people in the leadership in both parties, could lead us to that point. I don't think this country has been really all that well served by this election, and so we'll see what happens today and how the political parties respond to that. There's an awful lot of predicting going on here that we're going to have 2 years of fierce partisan gridlock. I'm not so sure that's the case, because I remember people predicting the same thing in November of 1994.
And you in a different column talked about that, how we're referring to when Bill Clinton was in the middle of his first presidential term,
right.
and a Republican majority. In fact, the Democrats lost control of Congress for the first time in 40 years back in 94. And you had led by Newt Gingrich, the as it was called, GOP revolution of the 90s. There wasn't gridlock, but there sure were some showdowns there.
Absolutely. The government was shut down twice.
Right.
And, it was messy, but there was also progress made on areas that you would not have predicted in November of 1994 there would have been progress made.
Such as?
Well, welfare reform, among others. Reform in the form of cutting deficits, that sort of thing. Now, granted, the problems that we faced back then were not nearly as substantial as they are today, with a $1.4 trillion deficit and some very serious ticking time bombs going on in our entitlement programs across the board. But do not underestimate survival instincts of politicians, in particular people who are going to be facing election in 2 years. There are going to be 34 Senate seats up for re-election in 2012, and depending on how a couple of seats go today, 23 of them could be held by Democrats. And if they see a number of their fellows going down today, fellow Democrats in the Senate going down today, after taking tough votes for President Obama's positions. They may reconsider after this, and the pressure could come from within the Democratic Party to make some progress on things like trade, on energy, on deficit reduction in particular. And don't forget, on December 1st, this bipartisan commission that the president has appointed is going to come in with some fairly substantial and, I would guess, very serious recommendations on what we need to do to reduce spending and to reduce the deficit. And so there will be a lot of pressure, I think, on, you know, both not only from Republicans, but perhaps from within President Obama's own party to cut some deals on some of these major issues.
Our guest is Chuck Rausch. He is a writer for Gannett and is seen in the Sioux Falls Argus Leader. His work is seen in the Sioux Falls Argus Leader as well as USA Today. If you have a comment or question, we're looking for folks to gauge your mood on Election Day. Are you breathing a sigh of relief today? Are you glad that the campaigns are coming to an end and that a decision will be made today on a number of office holders, potential office holders, and referendum? Or are you bemoaning what has happened over the last few months? Do you feel that it is a process that has served the voters well? 800-524-3604 is the number to call. Again, 800-524-3604. Our email address is midday@sdpb.org. Chuck, I wanted to go back to talking one final question about the rally to restore sanity and or fear. By the way, what did you think of that title?
Well, I thought it was very clever, and it was catchy, and it certainly sort of caught the mood of the moment. There are those on the right who thought it was a little bit condescending, in a sense that if you're opposed to the Obama agenda, somehow you're not exactly sane or whatever. And I do think in that regard they might have had a point. But that's who Jon Stewart is. He pokes fun at people, and he's a brilliant satirical comedian / political commentator. And he's not the first of his genre. Dick Gregory, Mort Saul, others in the past have done the same thing. They just haven't had sort of the multi-level platforms that Stewart and Colbert have. And the other thing is, let's be honest here. I mean, he's got a huge following, but if you probably asked most Americans, they probably don't follow him every day. They don't watch him every day. But he certainly is, he's certainly important in the political discourse of today.
Now, do you agree? This is the question I wanted to get to. Do you agree with the news organizations, National Public Radio included, that said that told their employees that they did not want them to attend? They were forbidden to attend this rally.
I don't understand that. I go to things on my. I'm a reporter, and I'm an object. I try to be an objective reporter. We're all humans, but I think it would be derelict if you cover the beat, or if you're at all interested in public affairs, to not go to stuff like this if you're covering politics, or even if you're working for a news organization. I don't see any problem in going, as long as you're not openly participating or whatever like that. It's the same thing.
But I think that's what
the Glenn Beck rally, I think it would have been the same thing.
Right, and I think that's what the concern was for among the different organizations, NPR among them, that if it went beyond simply covering the event and participating, that there was a concern. So that's what I'm asking, whether you agree with that.
Participating is a different thing. But just going to watch or observe, I thought it was just over the top. Frankly, I wouldn't have advised folks to do that. I don't advise people to march in parades or that sort of thing. But I think if you're just going to see what it looks like, if you're a citizen of Washington D.C., I think you have every right as a citizen to do that. I would offer the same advice for the Glenn Beck rally in August. If you want to go down and see what it was like, I don't think there were any sort of directives at that point, were there, to not go to the Glenn Beck rally?
I don't recall any, but that doesn't mean that there weren't any.
Yeah, I mean, I think the timing of this, frankly, with what happened with Juan Williams, probably had something to do with it. That's just my speculation.
800-524-3604 is the number to call. And our guest, Chuck Rausch of Gannett. Let's go to the phones. We have Chris from Yankton on the line. Chris, welcome to Dakota Midday.
Well, thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
Listening to the individual you were interviewing, and he talked about the Democrats seeing the writing on the wall and maybe cutting deals with the Republicans. I don't think the Republicans have anything to offer other than tax breaks for the very wealthy, et cetera, et cetera. And how the electorate could divine anything from what they offered in this run-up to the election is just way beyond me. And as far as cutting deals, I don't think it's in the Democrats' best interest to cut deals, because the kind of deals the Republicans want to cut are really run counter to everything the Democrats have to talk about. And also I think it would be a work of detriment on the 2012 elections if they started cutting deals when the Republicans wouldn't even talk to them when they were the minority.
Well, Chuck is right here, and yep. Chuck, correct me if I'm wrong, but I would not characterize what you were saying as necessarily being advice for the Democrats. You were simply looking
right
into what they will do, what will be the matter of the practical approach if what many are predicting turns out to be true, and that is the
right
Republicans winning one or more houses of Congress in this election.
Well, I would say two things. Thanks for the call, Chris. I think Chris is right on one point. In the predicate, I do think the Republicans, if they do take control, particularly of the House, have done so without running a very specific campaign. It's mainly, you know, a pushback campaign, and we're not we're not the president's party. But I was at the event where John Boehner and other Republican leaders announced their new contract with America, and they were asked a number of specific questions on areas of where they would propose cutting government and whatever. And all of that sort of genre of question was sort of pushed back. They said, well, you know, that'll be for after the election, and they're going to have some very tough choices because they're going to have a new conservative contingent, particularly in the House, I believe, who's going to come in here and is not going to stand for not doing things on cutting government and whatever. I also will point out to Chris that there have been some, within the last couple of days, some indication that Democrats may be willing to do things on taxes. Senator Menendez, who's the head of the Democratic Senatorial Campaign Committee, was quoted over the weekend as saying there may be a possibility that all of the Bush tax cuts that were passed in 2001 could be extended, and with the tax cuts on higher income people extended for a certain period of time and making them permanent. In other words, there might be some wiggle room there on Democrats' opposition to people over $250,000, maybe a 2 or 3 year extension of that and a permanent extension of the middle class tax cuts. But I disagree with him on a couple of other points, non-tax points. If you look at the rhetoric of President Obama and some Democrats, for instance, on issues like nuclear power, they agree on that, and there could be some sort of energy legislation that's built around that, and electric cars and innovation and tax credits for that. The other thing I would look at is trade legislation, which has been held up. I believe we're going to see substantial activity on trade legislation. Now, it might not be the kind of things that Chris thinks that the Democrats can take back to the country and get reelected in 2012, but it would be considered progress, because I don't believe either side wants to go into 2012 after treading water for 2 years and not doing anything, particularly if the economy is still in this shape over the next 24 months.
Chris, your thoughts before we let you go?
Anytime the topic of trade comes up, all I can think of is transporting jobs out of the country. When we talk about improving trade, it seems like there's been an imbalance, a huge imbalance for a long time, and it's kind of like something people have come to live with. But what it turns out in practical words is that trade is having Mexico make car parts or whatever, however you can find the cheapest source of labor in the world.
Well, and you can say that, but one fact that we know from the early 90s is that Bill Clinton signed the NAFTA agreement. So, you can
I think there are people who would appreciate what you're saying, but then there are also some folks who would remember that little piece of history and wonder about.
I think a lot of people remember that little piece of history.
Yeah. Not so little. Chris, thank you for the call. We appreciate
thank
it.
Thank you, Chris.
Have a good day.
Thank you. You too. We need to wrap this up, Chuck, but I wanted to just leave you with this thought, kind of bringing this conversation full circle, and that is your host at the event or your co-host at the event on Saturday that you covered, Stephen Colbert, coined the term a few years ago, truthiness, in a satirical skit that essentially bemoaned the fact that too often in our political discourse, rhetorical stunts trump the truth.
Right.
What about that idea as it pertains to the election of 2010?
Well, you know, we were talking about this the other day. One of the trends in my industry is a lot of news organizations and, frankly, a lot of nonprofit watchdog groups have begun doing, you know, watchdog stuff on ads, on statements in newspapers and on television and interviews and that sort of thing. And so it certainly is a recognition that we need to, be out there as sort of arbiters of whether or not people are telling the truth in making their arguments and whatever. In a highly charged political environment, it's even before the age of the internet, it was a tough job. But in the age of the internet, repetition sometimes becomes quote unquote truth. And it just makes it really, really hard. And frankly, I feel sorry for the average voter today, because it's hard to sort this stuff out. It's hard to know who's telling the truth. I spent a day with a congressional candidate in Northwest Pennsylvania, and she was in Erie, Pennsylvania, and she was, going door to door. And she is a Democrat, but she is opposed to abortion. And there have been a number of ads on the air that basically said that she'd sold out and that she had flipped her position on abortion, and she seriously had not, and in fact had fought pretty hard in the health care bill to get provisions in there that would not allow federal funding of abortions, but yet she was going door to door and people were confronting her with quote unquote facts from this ad, and she was pretty weary at the end of a couple of blocks because she kept getting hit with it. And that's the kind of thing that I think the environment that we're in right now is people, it's harder for people to sort out what's true and what's not true in this environment.
Well, wasn't it Mark Twain who said that Mark Twain said that a lie will find its way around the world before the truth gets its boots on?
Right. Yep. It's unfortunate, but it's true.
Chuck Rosch writes from Washington for Gannett, and you can read him in the Sioux Falls Argus Leader, USA Today. Chuck, as always, a pleasure visiting with you. Happy Election Day to you, and don't work too hard today.
You do a great job, Paul, and thanks for having me on.
Well, thanks.
Yep.
My honor. Thank you.
Yep. Bye.
Bye, Chuck. Coming up, we'll talk with another writer, Jim Reese, who is from Yankton, teaches at Mount Marty College, and has been nominated for a little thing called the Pulitzer Prize for his most recent collection of poetry called Ghost on Third. We'll talk to Jim about that. Here's some readings of his poetry next here on Dakota Midday on SDPB Radio. Welcome back to Dakota Midday. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. Yankton writer Jim Reese has just been nominated for a Pulitzer Prize for his most recent collection of poetry called Ghost on Third. He is an assistant professor of English at Mount Marty College, which is in Yankton, and I've been calling him Yankton Writer, but even though he also works teaching inmates at Yankton Federal Prison Camp, he wanted me to point out that he does, in fact, live in Nebraska, and is obviously a proud Cornhusker. Joins us here in our Vermilion studios. Jim Reese, welcome to Dakota Midday. How are you?
I'm good. Thanks, Paul, for having me.
Where in Nebraska are you?
We live in Hardington, Nebraska.
Like a lot of folks who work in South Dakota do. And this is very interesting. I hold in my hand your latest book, Ghost on Third. First of all, congratulations on being nominated for a Pulitzer Prize.
Thanks.
This happened just recently. When did you find out?
It's been about 3 weeks. So the publishers, New York Quarterly Books, they notified me that they nominated the book. And, I just got to keep my fingers crossed at this point. I think we find out sometime early spring. I think if we got on the website, I could double check
That's a long... Well, either way, you're talking 4, 5, 6 months here. Yeah. So, well, don't think about it too much then. let's talk poetry. The book is rather amazing, and it's based on, as I understand it, I mentioned that you do some work with the Yankton Federal Prison Camp with inmates there, including a journal they published called 4 p.m. Count, which we'll talk about. But the book, Ghost on Third, springs from work that you recently participated in a similar outreach program at San Quentin Prison in mm-hmm. California. How did this all come about?
You know, I tell people every once in a while, it's kind of like an angel walked in my office. The head of education at the Yankton Federal Prison Camp, Maureen Steffen, the Federal Bureau of Prisons had been granted money from the National Endowment for the Arts, and so they had come up to Mount Marty College and asked if there was a writer who would be qualified to work as a writer in residence for the National Endowment for the Arts. So that's how it all really started about 3 years ago. So this will be the fourth year if all things go as planned. I spent months trying to prepare, and what they did right away, they sent us to, five of us in the country right now that work in arts and corrections. And so they sent us to San Quentin Prison right away. Which was, as you can probably imagine, very intimidating. But they have one of the best programs as far as arts and correction goes. And so we spend a couple of days there watching all the various classes and then try to take what we learn there and incorporate them back in our own programs.
So this is a writer's project that you do with the inmates.
Yeah.
And some people might find that curious and almost maybe, for lack of a better term, an oxymoron that you would be, teaching the people that a lot of people might presume are uneducated or have no interest in this. What did you find when you approached some of these inmates about writing?
I want to answer. I've got a couple of things to answer that. I think one of the things right away to get at the heart of this program and the question and what I learned right away. When I was at San Quentin, I heard someone talk about, you can lock somebody up and teach them a trade while they're in prison. And that's great. Maybe they get out and they can become a plumber. But what you have to do is also help them tap into that emotional instability that brought them to prison in the first place. And arts and education, I think, helps open that door. If a person never comes to terms with themselves, you're just going to send an angry plumber right back out into society. I believe in that idea. This is something, I walk both sides of this fence. I don't agree with, I don't have any sympathy for people that premeditate and execute heinous crimes. But I've learned a lot from being within the federal prison system and going to these different prisons about why some people are there. And it's not what everybody thinks.
Well, and what is it?
It's various things, some of them don't have anywhere else to go. That's been one of the things that I've noticed, especially at San Quentin. I think a lot of it is where I teach. What I see a lot in Yankton is an addiction problem. And some people that just fell into some bad times. And so I hope that you see more programs in the country geared toward that to help people with rehabilitation. And so those are two of the main problems that I've seen.
When you embark on teaching an inmate about writing, to what extent do you, as I understand it, you don't worry about rules. You're not there to teach grammar and syntax and subject and verb agreement necessarily, as you are about kind of getting at what's really going on inside of one of these people and how to bring it out in an artistic way.
Yeah, when I first went into prison, I was really prepared. I had planned my syllabus out for months, and I had it mapped down to the minute because it's a 3-hour class. So, you have two small breaks in between there, and so you have to keep them busy doing various things. And when I got there the first day, someone said, "What's the difference between poetry and prose?" And I realized no matter how much I'd planned, I was just going to have to throw the syllabus out the window and start from scratch. So it continues to challenge me in that way, but in turn, I know it's made me a lot better professor. It's made my work richer for the show. I spend 10 months with them, and what their final goal is they want to be published in the journal 4 p.m. Count. One thing that we do through the NEA is I take some of the money that the NEA pays me, and then I bring writers from throughout the country into the Yankton Federal Prison Camp. I pay them, and they spend a day workshopping with them. And the class then, in turn, as a whole, writes each writer a letter. Or, you know, they'll write a letter, and then the writer actually responds back to the class later on, you know, a month or so after they've left. And we publish – they respond about issues about craft and things like that, and then we publish those letters in 4 p.m. Count, too. So I think they're a valuable tool not only for folks in the class but also for, you know, anybody teaching creative writing. And there's something – we don't sell the journals. We use them as educational tools, so – we try to give them to those teachers and students that can benefit from them.
So what, when the guy asks you, what's the difference between prose and poetry, what? How did you respond?
Oh, I think I said it's time to take a break. I can't remember exactly. I think...
apparently you said something about forget the rules.
Yeah, I think that's the first thing that scares them. And another thing that really scares them when we talk about poetry is rhyme. We've been taught from an early age that all poetry has to rhyme. And so I really start talking about voice, and I try to tap into that. I think everyone has a story. And once they realize that, you know, in the journal they can do whatever they want, then their voice really starts to shine. So I encourage that. I encourage them to write stories about their own lives, or perhaps a restorative justice letter to someone or even themselves. That could be another assignment. I mean, I really do have close to probably 100 different assignments that I give these guys. I would have to count them all up, but we spend a lot of time going from one assignment to the next, and hopefully one of them clicks.
We're talking with Jim Reese, who is an assistant professor of English at Mount Marty College in Yankton. He is author of 4 collections of poetry. The most recent, Ghost on Third, was recently nominated for a Pulitzer Prize, and it's based on his experiences teaching inmates at the Yankton Federal Prison Camp and most recently the San Quentin Prison Outreach Program in California. These experiences found their way into Ghost on Third. Talk a little bit about how you came up with the idea for this book and what it's predicated on.
You know, the poems in this book are pretty wide-reaching. There's all kinds of different themes, from poems about my daughters to poems about the Great Plains, and I try to mix as much humor in the book as well as what I'm experiencing. I'm a confessional poet, so I just write pretty much whatever I can, you know, and... part of the program, too, through the NEA is to the guys want to see you writing. So I have to spend so much time there writing and them actually watching me what I do. So, you know, inevitably I end up writing about the place I'm working at. I end up writing about San Quentin and these guys and what I'm learning, you know, about humanity and about the whole system. You know, we're the worldwide leaders in incarceration, and the United States, and I think education is the key to turning this around.
Let's hear one of the poems. We asked you to pick out, you know, 2 or 3 really selections that you're really proud of, and
okay.
Do you enjoy doing this kind of thing? A little live, you know, what could be better than a man, a microphone, live all of South Dakota and many parts of Nebraska and Minnesota and Iowa can hear you? What would you like to share?
You know, that's always a tough decision.
I'm not making you
trying
nervous,
to,
am I, Jim?
No, I'm just...
okay, good.
I'm trying to get the best poem here for you. This is something that came out of the class, and it's something I'm proud of. One of my favorite poems in the book. This is called Vernon is Taking the Dirty Dog Home.
Okay.
On these common grounds, you hope you never run into each other again. I daydream that maybe I'll spot some of you, holding your children's hands, running your tattoo parlors, catfishing in your favorite holler holes, facing your demons the best you know how. I think maybe I played a part in some of this. This, a place any of us could have wound up in after a few misdirected decisions. Imagine a greeting from an aging mother who still relentlessly milks the Holsteins, imprisoned on her own farm. The smell of rotten silage, the overwhelming burden of not having enough time. She, though, will be waiting at our threshold, doors wide open for you. And imagine the toy brontosaurus on laminate flooring, pointing its head to your child's bedroom. You will be welcomed again. And when you, Vernon, board that bus to the halfway house, keep your head high. With smart time, you'll have only 2 months to go. And I've been instructed never to get too close to any inmate, but I'm your teacher, and I'm afraid that's just not possible. So tonight, like most nights, I carry you home.
That's Jim Reese, and the name of that selection again was?
Vernon is taking the dirty dog home.
And Vernon was presumably an inmate?
Yeah, I changed the name.
Okay. You obviously have a lot of sympathy, or maybe sympathy is not the right word, but you empathize with these individuals. A lot of people wouldn't feel sorry for these guys, but you seem to have you don't seem to look at it as a black and white thing. Where does that come from?
It's come from teaching in the program. You know, I grew up in Omaha, Nebraska. I went to a high school where I watched a friend of mine rape and I didn't watch. I went to school and heard that a friend of mine raped and then found out later that he killed a friend of mine. So, when I say I don't have any sympathy for those that premeditate and execute these crimes, I mean it. But I think there's also another side to the story that I was totally unaware of until I started working in the prison system. And, and the guys that I work with at the Yankton Federal Prison Camp, most of them are in there for drug-related crimes. And I think, when I go back to the word addiction, I think you have to really look at it that way. And there's some programs that they have established. There are some very successful programs that help these men. So when they come back into society, that's not a problem for them anymore. And I think that's important. And you can look at it at San Quentin. That goes on, too. So that's where a lot of this work comes from.
And kind of the idea that maybe there before the grace of God go I?
I hope so.
Jim Reese is our guest, and again, his latest collection of poetry is called Ghost on Third. It's been nominated for a Pulitzer Prize. The term Ghost on Third, I know it being a sports fan and a baseball player or one time I played, and you'd be with the kids in the neighborhood, and there wouldn't be enough kids for everybody to stand on base. You'd be the kids. There'd be like maybe a handful of neighborhood kids playing a stickball in an alley, and you'd be on base. But then somebody would have to come in and hit. It was his turn at bat, even though he was still on base. So you'd say ghost on third.
Yep.
So is that?
That's exactly where it came from.
Why here? Why apply it here?
It just worked at the end of this poem, and I had been playing kickball in the gymnasium with my nieces, nephews, and my daughters, and I heard someone say that, and it took me back immediately to being a kid, and it fit with the poem, and the poem is actually a poem by my grandfather who has Alzheimer's and is in a nursing home, so that's where that comes from, but it also fits with the book because there's a lot of poems about my kids in there as well and things like that.
Do you have that one handy, the Ghost on Third?
Sure.
I got a hankering for that one now that we've been talking about it, so go ahead.
Ghost on Third. At dusk, with my grandpa Cecil and his soothsayer fishing buddy Russ, I am on all fours hunting crawlers. They hold flashlights and PBRs as, with my tweezer fingers, I wait to attack. Don't let go, Junior, one says. That's a keeper, all right. I follow the light beams back and forth, attack, squeeze, and pull until the night crawlers give or split in two. And Grandpa, it's 25 years later and I'm half a world away. You, skinny as hospital tissue, lying in a nursing home bed. Me, on my knees, crawling in garden rows, searching for crawlers, engulfed in dirt, bull snake, and mosquitoes. The last time we fished, I had to ask for help to lift you from the boat onto the dock. Bluegills and bass gone to grass carp the size of Harleys. But this will never end. I will take the girls. I will tell them about the fish hook in my mother's head, how I saved you from not jumping overboard, how we hammered fish for years. Sleep, Grandpa, sleep. You are the ghost on Third, and I'm sending you home.
I like that one.
Thanks.
That's and I can see the emotion that you feel when you share that as you just did with the audience. You mentioned earlier, you used the term, a term that I'm not really familiar with, a confessional poet. You said, I'm a confessional poet. What does that mean exactly?
You know, I'm a fan of, I guess I can go back to Sylvia Plath. I could say I'm a narrative poet too. I'm going to tell it like it is, the way I see it. And I guess I just hope either you like it or you don't. I'm not going to try to sugarcoat anything for anyone. And that seems to be working out all right so far, so I'm going to keep trying to do that. I don't have the particular definition of confessional poet, but a lot of people have said that to me after their readings. You know, you're very confessional. You don't hold anything back. And I suppose I try not to. If I were to hold things back, it wouldn't make me the writer that I am. So,
is that what helps you when you work with these inmates?
Yeah, you have to be very honest with those guys. You know, if I just talking about it, I get nervous at times. You know, being there, you know, and especially being in San Quentin and things like that, I was very intimidated at first. I mean, that's kind of par for the course. You have all these things that you see on TV or these shows like Lockdown and all that kind of thing. And then when you go in there, it's a totally different story, but it's something that you won't see these art programs, a lot of them on CNN or, you know, some of these shows, because it's what it is. It's an art class. You know, there's no controversy actually within these classes. Everyone is treated equal, and that's something that doesn't happen, for example, like at San Quentin. You know, it's a very segregated place on the yard, but within this classroom, everybody is treated as an equal. So I think that's very important.
We have we're just about out of time, but we have time for maybe one more short poem if you have something quick that you'd like to end on.
You know, I want to liven it up a little bit.
Okay.
This is a poem that's in the book, and it's called This is Nebraska. And this is for a guy in New York City. When my wife and I were there, we were asking for directions, and he said, Nebraska, don't you guys still ride around in a horse and buggy there? And I said, you know, with the recession and all, we had to sell the buggy, but we kept the horse.
Touche.
So this is Nebraska. Pa said Bobby and me could go fishing down at Snake Creek just as soon as we graft this here calf and finish stacking round bales up in the loft of the barn. And Pa said we could go play with the Indians down the road, too. But Ma won't let us, on account of man sits in tree, is still fixing to finish skinning a buffalo and make himself a new teepee today. So today, like most days, we'll likely watch them big airplanes blow by overhead. I wish people would just stop every now and again for a visit. And I was fixing to go walk up the hill and pick some cherries, but Bobby got a tick stuck up in his britches. Ma said maybe he was up there doing more than picking cherries and won't let none of us go up the hill no more. And Ma predicts the Pony Express is due to arrive this week, and maybe Bobby and I can go sit at the end of the lane and wait for him and his horse. It's really nifty to see him race by and toss Bobby our stack of mail. And sometimes even, there's a Sears Roebuck catalog with girly pictures for us to look at in the outhouse. And maybe, just maybe, we could take the buggy to town and get us some candy, stare at all them city folk with their fancy hats and boots. And maybe, just maybe, we could take on a picture show while Pa does his business around town. Maybe Loretta Swenson, maybe she'll be there in town too. Yes'm, I do believe she's true.
a poem by Jim Reese, whose latest collection of poetry is called Ghost on Third. It's been nominated for a Pulitzer Prize. Jim teaches as an assistant professor of English at Mount Marty College in Yankton. He also teaches inmates at Yankton Federal Prison Camp and recently participated in a similar outreach program at San Quentin Prison in California. He lives, proud resident of Hardington, Nebraska, joined us here in our Yankton studios. Jim, thanks for being with us. We appreciate it.
Thanks a lot, Paul.
Jim Reese with us here on Dakota Midday. Coming up, we'll talk with Sioux Falls Argus Leader sports editor Stu Whitney about the ever bizarre season for the Minnesota Vikings, taking yet another weird turn with the release under mysterious circumstances of star receiver Randy Moss. That and more coming up on Dakota Midday on SDPB Radio. Welcome back to Dakota Midday. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. The Minnesota Vikings have released star receiver Randy Moss, who they signed just weeks ago. Moss is probably a Hall of Fame receiver who spent many great years with the Vikings before going on to set records with the New England Patriots. He ended up back with the Vikings and has now been released just weeks after they signed him. Just another strange twist in a bizarre season for the Vikings, and here to try to help us make some sense of it is, as he does quite often, is Sioux Falls Argus Leader sports editor Stu Whitney. Stu, welcome back to the program. How are you?
Paul, very good. I'm not sure if I will be successful in trying to make sense of any of this, because I don't think it's possible to make sense of some of the stuff going on at Winter Park these days, but I'll certainly give it my best shot.
Well, what happened? I find out last night, I think I saw it on The Crawl on ESPN, during the World Series coverage, that the Vikings released Randy Moss, and I thought, what? As I'm sure a number of others reacted. What happened?
I don't think anyone really saw it coming, including the media in the Twin Cities, because they had a press conference with Brad Childress earlier in the day, and he didn't mention anything about it, and they had asked him many questions about Moss, and it was just sort of a normal looking back at Sunday's game type interview and press conference. And then Ben Lieber, ironically, the former Vermilion standout here from South Dakota, was in the locker room, and a reporter asked for confirmation because he had heard something through NFL Network that they were going to maybe waive Moss. And then Lieber said, yeah, the coach pulled us in for a private team meeting, and they're getting rid of him. And now that's the big question is why, and a lot of people pointed to his post-game rant that he had after the loss of the Patriots about how much he still loved the Patriots and criticizing the Vikings coaching staff for not taking his strategic advice on how to try to beat the Patriots, and railing against the media and saying he wasn't going to talk to the media for the rest of the year. Now there's something coming out today on ESPN.com that Randy Moss had a huge rant against the restaurant that had catered the post-practice meal on Friday and made a huge scene insulting the restaurant owners and talking about he wouldn't feed that sort of food to his dog. So depending on which report you listen to, I mean, I think it's mainly just things being compounded of Randy Moss being Randy Moss and Childress getting frustrated with it and just deciding to sort of cut bait, which did not – another story, of course, did not go over well with Ziggy Wilf, the team owner.
That the release did not go over well?
Apparently the lines of communication were not real solid, and Wilf was not – notified that Moss is going to be waived. And considering the Vikings, if Moss clears waivers, they could be on the hook for the remaining money on his deal, which
I think it's
less than $4 million.
Yeah,
I think
that's a lot of. I can see why the owner might be a little upset about
that's
that.
Not chump change, even for Ziggy Wilf.
No, but the chances are that he probably will get picked up. But as far as the Vikings are concerned, this is not something that they need on top of all of the Brett Favre drama. And what are the chances now that Brad Childress, the coach, has completely lost control of the team and that it will implode here in the coming weeks?
Well, I think it's quite possible he's already lost control of the team. I think the stage was set during training camp, and you and I, Paul, have talked about the Brett Favre thing and sort of the special treatment he got, not having to show up at training camp the last 2 years and the sort of circus that surrounded that. When you think about it, you know, there's a little bit of a double standard, because everything that we're talking about with Randy Moss essentially happened with Brett Favre, too. You know, he's questioned the coach's strategy. He's certainly been a disruption off the field. He's struggled with his on-field performance. And you know, they're not obviously going to waive Brett Favre, but they're certainly going to maybe question the way that they handled him and allowing him to sort of set his own rules. And when players in the locker room see that, you know, they start wondering about how strong and stable the head coach is. And I think you need to have a stronger presence in that head coaching spot than what Childress has done. And you sort of live and die with your decisions. They sort of sold their soul to this whole Brett Favre thing last year, and it worked out for them. I think their luck has run out, and that that feeling of, well, let's just let the guy do what he wants as long as he can win for us, is sort of pervaded the locker room, and now they're doing what the players are doing what they want, but they're not winning.
Mm. Stu Whitney joining us, sports editor of the Sioux Falls Argus Leader. Stu, 30 seconds left. I just wanted to quickly talk about the high school football playoffs. Next week are the championship games at the Dakota Dome. And we've got, I think we're up to the semifinals now, and we have four Sioux Falls teams.
We do. If anyone was, if there's any doubt about the dominance of Sioux Falls in Class 11 AA high school football, they were alleviated last night, because now you've got Washington playing Lincoln in one semifinal, and Roosevelt playing O'Gorman in the other semifinal on Saturday at Howard Wood Field. So it's sort of like a President's Bowl type doubleheader to decide who goes to the Dakota Dome, and that will guarantee a Sioux Falls champion for the seventh straight year as well. So it's I think bad news for the rest of South Dakota when they look at how Sioux Falls is really getting it done in high school football right now.
And we'll have to have you back when you do your all-state team. Stu Whitney, sports editor of the Sioux Falls Argus Leader, joining us from Sioux Falls. Thanks so much, Stu. Really appreciate your being with us.
All right, Paul. We'll talk to you soon.
You bet. And SDPB Radio brings you election 2010 results tonight, beginning with NPR coverage at 7 Central, 6 Mountain Time, and local coverage expected to begin during 8 o'clock Central, 7 Mountain Time. That's national and South Dakota election coverage on member-supported SDPB Radio tonight. That'll do it for me for now. Until tonight, I'm Paul Guggenheimer. We'll see you tomorrow with a Dakota Political Junkies edition of Dakota Midday.